In central Anatolia, an Indo-European people emerged among chaos and war. And these people would create a civilization that would have a lasting effect on all of the civilizations in the region, as well as the West to follow. This civilization would create a language that so far is the oldest known example of the family of languages that would eventually give us the same language I'm using in this presentation, which is, of course, English. That family of languages is known as the Indo-European family. For me, these rugged, practical people were remarkably similar to the early Romans. Their rise to power could be seen to be similar to the Roman rise to power. Both civilizations began as second-class citizens, with the Romans playing second fiddle to their Etruscan masters. Both civilizations emerged among constant struggles for survival, with the Romans emerging from wars with other Latin tribes, the Sabines and the Etruscans. Both civilizations learned early on the value of assimilating other cultures, with the Romans assimilating Etruscan and Greek cultures. Both civilizations developed a pragmatic character, built upon a perhaps well-founded paranoia for survival. Both civilizations perfected the art of war. Both civilizations were urban planners who designed cities with purpose and function. The key part of this story that I'm about to tell you is this, that fear and appeals to loyalty are the great builders of empires. Empires that benefit, first and foremost, the rulers. This is the story of the Hittites and the discovery of their empire 3,000 years after it died. So just to set this up, around the end of the 3rd millennium BCE, an Indo-European people entered Anatolia, which is present-day Turkey. The origins of these people are unknown. They entered into central Anatolia, where a people called the Hatians already existed. And the Hatians would be to these people what the Etruscans were to the Romans, their teachers, and eventually their first major conquest. During the 18th century BCE, the Hatians were the dominant power in central Anatolia at a time when there were constant wars happening between the city-states of Anatolia. The reality of Anatolia was this: conquer or be conquered. Out of this turmoil, an Indo-European people eventually conquered the Hatians. They took on many of their customs, including their religion, their art, as well as their architecture. The land itself became known by this Indo-European people as the Land of Hatti, named after the people they conquered. We know these Indo-Europeans as the Hittites, a name derived from diplomatic letters found in Egypt, the Amarna letters, which refers to their kingdom as the Kingdom of Keta, which is understood to mean the Kingdom of Hatti, along with references from the Jewish texts, now known as the Old Testament, which refer to a Canaanite tribe as the Hittites, which may or may not actually be these same Hittites. Now, the Hittites, however, they refer to themselves as the Nasili, and I'm going to continue to refer to them as the Hittites, even though they called themselves the Nasili, and I'm doing that only because that's what all the scholars continue to refer to them as. But if you want to, mentally in your mind, insert Nasili instead of Hittite. And I'll reference it now and again just to keep that awareness close to the surface. So in this presentation, I'm first going to go over the historical record. This would be the names and dates parts of the presentation. And after that, I'm going to talk about their city, their culture, and the way in which these people were discovered. Finally, I'm going to present to you why I believe the Hittites or the Nasili matter. and what the nature of the Hittites tells us about ourselves, as well as what the circumstances surrounding our awareness of the Hittites tells us about assuming we have an understanding of history at all. So let's begin then. I say we begin with the names and dates, the historical record, such as we understand it, of the rise and fall of the great empire of the Hittites. 1650 BCE, according to Hittite writings, marked the start of the first united Hittite kingdom under Hattusili, which simply means man from Hattusa. He also established the capital of the Hittite kingdom as Hattusa. Later on, we're going to look into a lot more detail about the nature of the creation of that city. Hattusili expanded the kingdom to eastern Anatolia and parts of Syria. And the policy of conquest, well, it was pretty simple. If you surrendered, you were given mercy and left alone. If you did not surrender, you were enslaved. Or worse, you're simply killed. So Hattusili was known as being a bit of a self-promoter. His scribes shared many stories of Hattusili comparing him to gods, and even comparing certain intimate body parts to being new. And so I'll read just a little part from some of his self-promotion there. His frame is new, his breast is new, his penis is new, his head is of tin, his teeth are of those of a lion, his eyes are those of an eagle, and he sees like an eagle. Yeah, that's quite an introduction. That is how I want to enter a room from now on. Whenever I'm about ready to enter a room, I need to have trumpets blare, and I need to have someone say, perhaps in Morgan Freeman's voice, his frame is new, his breast is new, his penis is new, his head is of tin, his teeth are those of a lion, his eyes are those of an eagle, and he sees like an eagle. Hattusili's conquest efforts, however, well, they were stopped by a coalition of Syrians led by the city-state of Aleppo. Somebody tell Gary Johnson somebody else knew where Aleppo was. And actually, stopped the first Hittite king. Yeah. Mersili, Hattusili's successor and grandson, conquered most of Anatolia, save for the east coast and northern coast. And just for kicks, he also marched his army 1,000 miles south, where he sacked Babylonia, and the year was 1595 BCE. And of course, what do you do after you sack the great city of Babylon? Oh, you just go back home. That's what he did. He sacked the city and turned right around and went back home. So in 1590 BC, after all the war and in the conquesting, the returning victorious king was not met with parades, but rather he was met with hot, steaming death. Mersili was assassinated by his brother-in-law, which launched the Hittite kingdom into 60 years of civil war. During this period of time, there were numerous kings, with few lasting more than a couple of years. It was a dangerous job, with each king being killed by his successor. Ah, that's not good work. You don't want to get that kind of work. So there were no dynasties. There were only a series of assassinations and internecine wars. But it's 1525 BCE, and finally, stability returns to Hattusa in the form of King Telipinus, a name that for the Hittites would be as important to them as the name George Washington is to Americans today. By now, the kingdom was reduced to the size of a city-state, with most of its lands lost. King Telipinus was met shortly after he took the throne with news that his wife and son had been murdered by wannabe usurpers. And it is at this very moment in time that the very existence of the Hittite kingdom was in peril. And what Telepinus chose to do next could make or break the Hittites. And as you can gather from the comparison I've already made with him and George Washington, and from the fact that I'm giving you this presentation at all, Telepinus made the right choice. If he hadn't, I don't know what I'd be talking about today, but it wouldn't be this. After the assassins were brought before him, King Telepinus did not have them executed. Rather, what he did was he simply decided to have them banished from the kingdom and stripped of all their titles, and that was that. But he did a lot more than that, and it's the lot more, I believe, that really helped to stabilize the situation. He also set about creating a new standard of succession as a way to stabilize the throne, not just the throne to come, but even his very own throne. Telepinus, I would argue, and I will continue to make this case throughout this presentation, had discovered the useful stabilizing feature of at least a proto-version of the concept of rule of law, which is one of the reasons, one, not the only, but one of the reasons why the Hittites intrigued me and why I wanted to do this presentation. Telepinus wrote a law code of succession that came to be known as Telepinus's Proclamation. This proclamation would be the cornerstone of law for the Hittites. And for now, I'm going to leave it at that. But I will get into more detail about the document and the Hittite concept of law when I get to the cultural section of the presentation. I promise you. So keep listening. Telepinus also began to deploy new strategy for foreign policy, the use of treaties over conquest. And this would become a regular Hittite strategy going forward. As a matter of fact, I think it's nearly half or half or maybe even a little bit more than half of the known treaties of the time that archaeologists have found on record were actually, they involved the Hittites. They wrote a lot of treaties, and they were favorable to conquest, especially ones that gave them the fruit of conquest without the toil of conquest. So Telepinus began an age of peace that would last until around 1400 BCE. And this period of time is known as the Middle Kingdom or the Dark Age of the Hittites, because little records survive after Telepinus up until the end of this period. And it's highlighted by the rule of Hantili II, who ruled for about 50 years during the first half of the 15th century BCE. There's a good reason for this, which I'm going to get to shortly. In 1400 BCE, the peace had ended. The Egyptians and the Mitanni, they joined forces to take Hittite lands in Syria, while in eastern Anatolia, the Arzawa states rebelled and overthrew their shackles. They left the Hittites. From the north, and this was the most devastating of all the news, a people called the Kaska invaded the Hittites. Once again, the Hittite kingdom was reduced to the size of a small city-state in central Anatolia, but not Hattusa, because the capital city of Hattusa was now in the hands of the Kaska, where it would be for a couple of decades, or a few decades. And this is most likely why so many records are missing from the Middle Kingdom. Supililioma I would take the throne around the mid-14th century BCE, and he would go on to become the greatest of all the Hittite kings. His father was King Tudhaliya II. Despite Supililioma being the main general of his father's army, he was not named the successor. Rather, Tudhaliya II, Supililioma's younger brother, was named the successor. So Supililioma would rebel against his brother, killing him and taking the throne for himself. Afterwards, Supililioma quickly conquered the Casca, retaking the capital city of Hattusa. He then went on to conquer the rest of Anatolia. Subliloma then conquered northern Syria, finally going on the offensive against the Mitanni. He also formed an important alliance for the Hittites with the then wealthy Syrian city-state of Ugarit, which would be the main source of imported wealth for the Hittites over the next 200 years. Under Subliloma, the military was more thoroughly developed, with troops being composed of career soldiers. Echoing the traditions that would later be seen in the Spartans, the Hittites developed a program of intense, highly regulated training for their soldiers that began when they were just boys. Now, unlike the Spartans, not everyone was a soldier, but if you were selected to be a soldier, your training began very early. The military that Subliloma built would become the strongest military of its day, utilizing a combination of foot soldiers and chariots that were the most advanced of their kind. The innovation for the chariot was rather simple. They simply moved the axle for the wheels from the back to the middle, which allowed the Hittites to create chariots that were broader because the center placement made the chariots stronger. So the Hittites went into battle not with two soldiers on a chariot, but with three. At this point in his rule, Subliloma met a beautiful Babylonian princess named Maligno, and he wanted to marry her, but there was just this one little problem. Well, he was already married. Not only was he married, but in Hittite custom, the wife of the king was queen, and the queen had real political power. Not only was his wife queen, but she was also the mother of his sons, including his named successor. None of this, of course, stopped the king, who sent his wife away anyway in order to marry Maligno, who then became called Tawanana, the name given to all Hittite queens. This action would one day cause internal turmoil within the kingdom, but Subliloma, well, he'd be dead before that would happen. By the end of his rule, he had built an empire that included the northern Levant and restored all of the lost territories of Anatolia. His rule began with the Hittite kingdom at its lowest point, but ended with an empire that went beyond anything the Hittites had previously held. And in 1327 BC, Subliloma laid siege to the last stronghold of the Mitanni, Carchemish. Afterwards, the Egyptians sent him a letter, or rather the wife of the now dead King Tut sent him a letter asking for one of his sons to marry her and become ruler of Egypt. Of course, the king, well, he was a little skeptical. He dispensed with the business of conquering Carchemish, and then he sent an envoy to question the queen. Eventually, however, despite his continued skepticism, he sent his son to marry the queen, Ankhesenamun. His son never made it to the queen. You see, he was murdered. He was murdered almost immediately upon arriving in Egypt by the rivals to the queen. As you can imagine, the king was not happy. He proceeded to go on a rampage. Now, this rampage that he went on, well, it was going to lead to hard times, not just for the ones being rampaged, but for the rampagees as well. So he went on this rampage. He decimated Egyptian-friendly cities in the Levant and Syria, bringing back captives. However, he brought back more than captives, because with the captives came along a plague. So he took the plague into the city, and this decimated the Hittite population. The king himself fell victim to the plague in 1322 BCE. His named successor died a few months after he did, leaving the throne open for Mursili II, Subliloma's youngest son. And he took the throne as a young man. He's probably around 20 years of age, though that's not certain. Some assume that he was a child when he took the throne, but that doesn't seem likely either. He immediately faced challenges from kingdoms surrounding the Hittite Empire, but from within, the plague continued to annihilate the people, further weakening the empire. So there's a famous warning that was sent to Mursili, and this one was included in the Hittite records. It read, "You are a child. You know nothing and instill no fear in me. Your land is now in ruins, and your infantry and chariotry are few. Against your infantry, I have many infantry. Against your chariotry, I have many chariotry. Your father had many infantry and chariotry. But you, who are a child, how can you match him?" Clearly, the young king, he was going to have his hands full just holding on to the empire that his father left him. As a response to the plague, Mursili produced a series of writings called the Plague Prayers, which I'm going to go into more detail about in the cultural section of this presentation. In addition to the plague, Mursili also had to deal with his stepmother, Tawanana. Remember her? Now, I did tell you that she was going to cause trouble later on. Well, here it is. This is the later on. Now, remember, it was Mursili's mother who was cast aside so that this foreign princess could take her place. So, as you can imagine, the blood between them was, well, it was bad. I guess you could say there was bad blood between them. In addition to really not liking Tawanana, understandably, he also wanted his wife to assume the role of Tawanana, but the widow of Supililoma had a lot of personal political power in the court. In the ninth year of his reign, tragedy struck in a major way. Two of Mursili II's two strongest allies, his brothers, both suddenly died. His wife also took ill under mysterious circumstances. Despite much prayers, Mursili's wife died, which he attributed to the sins he inherited through his father, as well as the sins and perhaps actions of Tawanana. So he believed that Tawanana used black magic to kill his wife, even if he didn't believe it. It was a convenient accusation to make. He declared that anyone who knew sorcery in the royal family should be seized. In the royal decree, he used the word he, but everyone knew who he was talking about. He was targeting Tawanana. Surprise of surprises, oracles declared that Tawanana was guilty. But rather than executing her, Mursili had her banished from the court and removed from the office of Tawanana. Mursili was struck by an illness that rendered him unable to speak, yet he continued to write. Historians have viewed this illness as a response to the amount of stress he took upon himself, both in assuming the sins that he felt resulted in the plague, along with the deaths of his close brothers and his wife, and finally, the stress in dealing with the subterfuge, both from without and within, that threatened the empire. Now, despite all of this, Mursili would expand the empire of the Hittites to its greatest peak, adding lands to the west, further into Syria, and south in the Levant. And in 1295, Mursili, he died. In 1279 BCE, Ramses II, or Ramses the Great, became the Egyptian pharaoh. This is important because for Ramses, he had an ambition in mind that he had before he took the throne, but he fully intended on carrying out once he assumed the throne. He put a target on Hittite lands in Syria, leading to a showdown with the empire that would culminate in the Great Battle of Kadesh. Muwatalli II, the successor to Mursili, would be the Hittite king who would face Ramses in 1274 BCE at Kadesh. And by his side was his younger brother, Hattusili III, who served as his main general in the battle. This is important, so take note. It comes up pretty quickly here. 37,000 Hittite soldiers and 3,000 Hittite chariots faced off against 20,000 Egyptian units in what was, for that time, the largest recorded battle in history. The chariot battle was the largest of its kind, which would never be surpassed, with up to 3,000 Egyptian chariots facing off against 3,000 Hittite chariots. And this battle is the most well-documented of the ancient world, with both the Egyptian and Hittite scribes documenting the battle. Now, while the Egyptian records suggest an Egyptian victory, records found in Hattusa reveal the battle was at least a draw. Some would consider it a victory for the Hittites, though hardly a decisive one. The result of the battle led to a period of time of uneasy peace between the two superpowers, an uneasy peace that would not be settled until after Muwatalli's death. So while the Hittites did not decisively defeat the Egyptians, the battle did result in the cessation of Egyptian aggression against Hittite territories in Syria. The Hittites were also able to take back the lost Syrian territories the Egyptians had seized before the battle, but the news was not all good for the Hittites, for the battle also resulted in the Hittites limiting their own expansion efforts into Syria. In 1272, Muwatalli died, with his son, Urhiteshub, named as his successor. Urhiteshub's uncle, Hattusili, who we referenced earlier, was not at all happy with this choice. After all, it was not Urhiteshub by his side in battle. It was Hattusili. As you can imagine, Hattusili was not happy, but he respected the decision of his brother nonetheless. Hattusili was somewhat placated by being given land to govern in Upper Anatolia, but his reputation grew. He offered a stark contrast to the less effective rule of Urhiteshub, which is not a good thing. After 5 years, Urhiteshub decided the growing reputation of Hattusili was too much. He was becoming a threat to the throne, so Urhiteshub stripped him of all his titles and his land. Hattusili responded by going to war against Urhiteshub. He deposed Urhiteshub and became Hattusili III. Hattusili wrote a document called the Apology of Hattusili as a way to placate the royal court after he violated the rules of succession outlined by the Telipinus Proclamation. And this document is important for a number of reasons, but I'll discuss those in the cultural section of this presentation, so keep listening. What I will share now, though, is this. The apology worked. The royal court appeared to have been satisfied, and I say it had been satisfied because he wouldn't face any real challenge to his throne while he was alive, despite vanquishing the rightful successor. Hattusili married Puddaheppa, a priestess of his patron god Ishtar, who became the new Tawanana. She gained preeminence in the court, even adjudicating cases and advising her husband on foreign affairs. She would also profoundly affect the religion of the Hittites, which I'll cover again in the cultural section of the presentation. She became rightly viewed as the most powerful and influential woman of the Hittites. In 1259 BCE, a treaty was signed between Egypt and the Hittites. The treaty contained the seals of both Hattusili II and his wife Puddaheppa. The treaty declared peace between Ramses the Great and Hattusili III. A series of letters leading up to the treaty reveals that Puddaheppa was a key player in forming the treaty itself, with some letters from Ramses' wife, Nefertari, addressed directly to her and her alone. Under Hattusili III, a great building program was undertaken, with great temples built across the land. By 1240 BCE, Puddaheppa had assumed most of the duties of rulership as her husband, Hattusili, had fallen deathly ill. It would take another 3 years before he died in 1237 BCE. After this, things get a bit murky. The next succession of kings proved utterly feckless, with each successive king losing their territory and power. Just four more kings would rule after Hattusili. In 1200 BCE, the Hittites gave up their capital, Hattusa, moving to southeastern Anatolia, where their kingdom would die. And exactly what finished off the Hittites appears to have been their own internal struggle for power between rival factions. Civil wars emerged. The capital city itself struggled to get supplies. So near the end, it appears the Hittites set their own city on fire before heading to southeastern Anatolia. And perhaps the reasoning was that they'd rather not leave the fortifications for others to potentially use against them. The last vestige of the Hittite kingdom was ruled by Supiluliuma II, who died in 1178 BCE. The end of the Hittites comes also at the beginning of what is now referred to as the First Dark Age, or the Dark Age, or the Ancient Dark Age. It marks the end of the Bronze Age and begins a transition to the Iron Age, a transition that would take roughly 300 years. So while the Hittite Empire and kingdom died in Anatolia, however, Hittite culture did still survive, and it would continue to thrive in northern Syria and southeastern Anatolia for a few more centuries, though never regaining the glory of the old Hittite Empire and never again consolidating as one. Before I discuss the culture of the Hittites, I want to first talk about the heart of the Hittite Empire, the city of Hattusa itself. The capital city of Hattusa tells us something about the nature of the people that built it. What stands out about the city of Hattusa is, as capitals of empires go, it defies all convention of all other capitals. The city itself was not built on a natural trade route. It wasn't built on the coast. It wasn't built near a river. Now, there is a little caveat that I want to add here, and this is a little note about the city of Amarna, which you could argue was similar in nature to Hattusa. I want to make a few points about that. While Amarna, the short-lived Egyptian capital, intentionally built by the pharaoh Akhenaten, in the middle of a desert, could be said to have similar characteristics to this city, its brief existence, which was a few decades, can hardly be compared to the centuries of existence for Hattusa. Furthermore, and I think this is even more of a salient point, Amarna was built using the resources of a great empire. It was not the source of the flowering of a great empire such as Hattusa would become. The city of Hattusa was built 50 miles away from the nearest river. The city was built hundreds of miles away from any coastline. It was built in a remote, rugged region with little access in or out of the city, surrounded by, even built on the sides of mountains, almost smack dab in the middle of Anatolia, which is, of course, present-day Turkey. The location of Hattusa, due to its elevation, was also a poor choice. If you consider climate a factor, which I do, try not to put your city in a place where climate is not that great. The region suffered harsh winters, with the city being snowed in for months on end during the winter season. So, unlike all other empire capitals, save for the fleeting city of Amarna, Hattusa was not a city that emerged organically, but rather appears to be intentionally designed from the start. It was created to be a super fortress with miles of outer walls and acres of inner walls protecting the city's central building, the king's palace. Given the origins of the Hittites rising among a period where Anatolian city-states warred for supremacy, it makes sense, of course, that the Hittites would be so defensive-minded and so deliberate in that defensive design. The nature of the creation of the city itself reveals a lot about the nature of the Hittites, which, well, neatly transitions us to the culture of the Hittites. So I decided to separate the cultural aspect of the Hittites from the historical record for a couple of reasons. First, I wanted to create a space to focus solely on the cultural aspect of the Hittites without being interrupted by the names and dates aspect of the history. And second, I wanted you, the listener, to have an historical context to frame this cultural reality around. It is the cultural aspect of the Hittites, much more than the names and dates and who they conquered, that so intrigues me about this empire. And it was the driving force behind my desire to create this presentation in the first place, for reasons that I'll discuss after we get through this section of the presentation. Let's look at the Hittite or Nassili religion. The Hittite religion was pantheistic, with the Hittites adopting every god from every people they came across. They did this to such an extent that they became known as the people of a thousand gods. The Hittites reckoned they always wanted to have the gods on their side, even the gods of their enemies. Now, it also could be suggested, as I am now suggesting, that assimilating the gods of their enemies also blunted, in part, the useful method of demonizing the other. If the Hittites worship the same gods as you, then a significant division into the category of the other was now nullified. The parallels between them and the Romans here are obvious to those who studied the Romans to any degree, with the Romans being notorious for freely adopting the gods of their enemies as their own. Both civilizations, I believe, had learned from the start how advantageous it could be to assimilate the cultures of the people they conquered, with the Romans building a foundation based on Etruscan culture and the Hittites building a foundation based on Hattian culture. The Hittite gods themselves were anthropomorphic and are considered by many scholars to be, in many instances, the origins of the gods of the Greeks and later the Romans, such as Zeus for the Greeks and Jupiter for the Romans. The Hittite storm god, for instance, Teshub, is considered to be the source for the Greek Zeus, which is the direct source for the Roman Jupiter. The Hittites believed that the gods needed the offerings and devotions of the people, while the people needed the gods to be blessed in this world. The king was considered the chief priest of the kingdom. The king was considered to be the one who spoke to the gods on behalf of the people and who shared the will of the gods to the people. How convenient. He was also expected to curry favor from the gods to bless the Hittites in daily life and in war. Now, here's a key wrinkle here. The king, however, was the one the gods held accountable if his people did not properly worship the gods or conduct themselves in ways the gods considered good. With this information, you can now understand better how a king such as Mersili would assume the sins of his people when the plague struck and his brothers and wife died. The notion of a king taking on the sins of the people and being the one to face the wrath of the gods could also be said to be a prototype of the Christ model that would come more than 1,000 years after the Hittites had disappeared. Like the king of the Hittites, Christ the king also assumes the wrath of God for the sins of the people. From a Christian perspective, perhaps the Hittites had a shadowy glimpse of Christ, and thus they reflected this in their religion. From a non-Christian perspective, perhaps the religion of the Hittites had some influence on the Jewish tribes that, right around the time of the Battle of Kadesh, were beginning to write down their own sacred texts. Now, while the king was not considered born a god upon accession, he was considered to be adopted by the gods. While alive, the king was not considered a god. He was a mortal who was adopted by the gods. When the king died, though, he was said to have become a god. And you would never say that the king died. What you would say is that the king became a god upon death. You wouldn't even say he became a god upon death. You would announce the king has become a god. After all, he had been adopted as one while still immortal. So we talked about Queen Puddaheppa, the wife of Hattusili III, and chief priestess. Among many things attributed to her included documenting, codifying, and standardizing the customs and rituals of the Hittite religion. And this happened around 1265 BCE. She cataloged the different rituals and standardized them. She clarified the pantheon, including assigning a hierarchy of the gods. Most of you have heard of the Code of Hammurabi, written around 1754 BCE. A little less than 200 years after the Code of Hammurabi was written, the Hittites created their own law code, which is what we're going to cover next, the laws of the Hittites. So the Hittites, they were very contractually focused. You could say they were a litigious people. Litigious, they were legalistic. They were record keepers. They were contract makers. Many of the Hittites carried small stone cylinders with them that could be rolled on clay, creating seals that worked. They worked both as identification cards of sorts, as well as signatures on legal documents. And it wasn't uncommon for a Hittite to have more than one personal seal on him, which would be used for different types of contracts. These seals existed before the codification of their laws under Teleponus in 1525 BCE, as we briefly touched on in the history part of this presentation. The Teleponus Proclamation was written. The proclamation first dealt with rules for succession to the throne, but in addition to the rules for succession, the proclamation codified Hittite law, which was a compensation-based law, not a retribution-based law code like everyone else around them had, but there were some notable exceptions, which we'll cover. The law code was preserved and regularly revised, with records of the revision preserved alongside the original laws. It was a living, breathing law code. This effort by the Hittites to keep a record of the changes to their law code was totally unique to the ancient world at that time, such as we know it. The underlying motive for the laws formed by Teleponus was, ostensibly, an effort to satisfy the sun god, who demanded that vulnerable classes be protected from the exploitation by stronger classes. The underpinning religious belief that the king was liable for the sins of the people, that might also have been a factor in motivating Teleponus to write law codes intended to check the exploitations of the lower classes by the upper classes. Though the power reality might also suggest that, be it conscious or subconscious, the creation of these laws was a recognition of two dangers. And this is again entering into my supposition, my theory. The first danger was this: an upper class that could exploit the lower classes could also then create more power for itself, power that could challenge the throne of the king. The second danger was this: an exploited lower class could eventually revolt. Why is that so important? Well, this is the reason. The nature of the capital city, and you'll recall we described how precarious the existence of that capital city was due to the placement of the city in this remote area. And it was such that the margin between thriving and dying really wasn't that great. Any tumult within the city that affected the ability of the lower city to perform the hard work needed to keep the city going was a danger to the king and to the city itself. That would be a much more pragmatic reason, I support, for the king to have the motivation to write a law code that protected the lower classes from undue exploitation. Now, some laws that were created, however, were retributive in nature, such as the law that to challenge the decree of a dignitary, you could substitute the word judge, adjudicator, elder, would be penalized with a beheading. And that makes sense. It makes sense that there would be this exception, because unquestioning faith or submission to the judgment of the dignitaries, the adjudicators, elders, that was critical to the Hittite concept of what I would say was a proto-form of rule of law, which I support was the stabilizing factor of the empire. This proto-form of rule of law being found in the Hittite law code suggests, again, yet another way the Hittites may have influenced many civilizations around them. And even civilizations such as Greece and Rome that would come after the Hittites. I should note here that evidence in the Hittite records reveals that the Hittites were, in fact, in regular contact with the Mycenaeans, the predecessors of what would become classical Greece. To further make my case that the Hittites were, in fact, practicing a form of rule of law, let's look at, well, I believe, more evidence that suggests this was the case. The Hittites were precedent-based. They kept massive archives to refer to past precedent as a way to justify current action. This was based on a core belief that the present is an amalgamation of the past. Not only does the present need to reference the past for a good outcome in the here and now, but to ignore past precedent also puts the future at risk for turmoil. These records were not just references for laws, but for worship, for customs, for historical reference. Thus, they kept meticulous records to assure they had a solid past reference to fall back on. Because of this belief, scribes were critical to Hittite culture. Scribes began their education very early on. They were expected to know more than how to write in their own language. They were expected to be able to write in multiple languages. They were also expected to be well-versed in the histories of the people surrounding the Hittites. This can be rooted, I believe, to the very nature of their religion, which was accountability-based, with the greatest accountability falling on the king himself, who would pay the price for the sins of the people. The Hittites created a system of accountability that began with the gods themselves, who relied upon the people to sacrifice to them and to worship them. The gods, for their part, had to deliver to keep the people sacrificing and worshiping. But the people were also expected to deliver to the gods. What were they expected to deliver? Justice, fairness, to treat their neighbors well, to worship their gods, and offer sacrifices. Finally, though, the king was responsible to assure that the people delivered to the gods the justice, fairness, sacrifice, and worship they desired. And all of this required a clear understanding of what justice, fairness, sacrifice, and worship meant. And this created the need for precedent, to assure future generations that they were getting it right, else the system of accountability would be broken and everyone would suffer, including even the gods. What was demanded of the people was two things first and foremost: to fear the gods and be loyal to the king. The fear of the gods led to complex regulations that touched almost every aspect of their lives, including, by the way, regulations on when and how to have sex with one another. Disloyalty to the king, to the city, was an offense that could lead to maiming or even death. As we look at Hittite literature, we're going to come across yet what I am supporting is more evidence that the Hittites practiced a form of rule of law well before the Greeks and the Romans. The Hittites had a vast record of literature preserved in Hattusa. These stories also seem to have influenced some of the stories in the Bible, as well as Greek and Roman mythology. I've already outlined how the nature of the relationship of the king to the gods was, well, it's kind of a proto-Christian archetype. For Greek and Roman religions, Hurrian myths of the origins of their gods, which were documented and altered by the Hittites, bear striking similarity to the Greek origin stories as reflected in the writings of Hesiod and Homer. Now we're going to get to the plague prayers, which is written around the early to mid-1400s BCE. Marsili II came to believe that the way his father, Supililioma, took power by killing his younger brother was the sin that caused the gods to inflict the land with the plague. So he attempted to make amends by pleading with the gods for forgiveness in public ceremonies. These ceremonies involved a ritual recitation of what has come to be called the plague prayers. These prayers appear to have been written by Marsili himself, and in the prayers he takes on the sins of his father and pleads for forgiveness from the gods. Also in the prayers, Marsili goes after his stepmother, the Babylonian queen, Tawanana, whom he blames for destroying his father's house from within. The plague prayers, they further illustrate how this particular king, Marsili, lived out his role as the king who took on the sins of his people and thus the wrath of the gods, the proto-Christ, if you will. The last example of Hittite literature that we're going to cover in this presentation also brings us back to our case for the Hittites practicing a form of rule of law. This is the Apology of Hattusili, which was written around 1267 BCE. After Hattusili III violated the Telepanese Proclamation's rules for succession by vanquishing his nephew, Uriteshub, he wrote one of the earliest preserved autobiographies in known written history, the Apology of Hattusili. In the document, he made a case for why he vanquished his nephew. The document details his early life at a level hitherto unheard of in the ancient world. He accused his nephew of plotting to take unjust action against his own people, thus compelling Hattusili to arrest him. During the time the apology was written, Moses was leading the Israelites out of Egypt and had begun to write what would become known as the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. Now, this next part, this is my personal theory, and I'll admit that it is not without issue, and I'll explain the issue. I think I overcome the issue, but not 100% sure. I'll leave you judge. Long before the Magna Carta hemmed in the power of King John in 1215, a precedent had been set in the Hittite kingdom that kings were not above the law. This is my theoretical assertion. Whether there was any truth to the claims in the Hattusili Apology is not as important as the fact that the royal court accepted the claims, and thus, de facto, conceded that kings were not above the law. Had they not conceded the point, then it can be argued, as I am, that the struggle for the throne would have continued as Hattusili would not have had the confidence of the most powerful people of the kingdom. However, some historians believe that the act by Hattusili led to the civil wars that would eventually undo the empire, but others, and I'm inclined to side with them, obviously, point out that the reign of Hattusili, it wasn't merely stable, it was a golden age of the Hittite Empire, with great building works completed and the full codification of their religion also set to record. So while warring factions may have used Hattusili's vanquishing of Uriteshub as a pretext to contesting the crown, the case can also be made that it wasn't the act that created the civil war, but the lack of the consolidation of power by any one man that necessitated the need to invoke Hattusili's transgression to attempt to gain leverage over rival factions. Now I want to talk about the discovery. What I have presented to you in this brief outline of the historical record, as well as the culture of the Hittites. It's relatively new information in the span of human history. It's information that comes 3,000 years after the last records of the Hittites were etched in stone or wedged onto clay. For 3,000 years, the story of the Hittites remained unknown, waiting to be discovered at the turn of the 20th century, with some information, such as how the Hittites fell, coming at the beginning of the 21st century. During the late 19th century, archaeologists were finding writings in a language that no one seemed to recognize. These artifacts, they were found in Egypt, they were found in Levant, and Mesopotamia, and even Anatolia, of course, Anatolia, which we now understand why. The mysterious language became an obsession for some. The artifacts all dated to a period of time between 1600 and 1100 BCE, a time that saw three great empires, Egypt, Babylon, and Assyria, rise and fall. And the speculation grew that perhaps there was a fourth great empire, which seemed ridiculous, but there was the claim. The earliest discovery of the Hittite language was by Ludwig Burckhardt, a Swiss traveler who discovered a petroglyph in the Syrian city of Hama. And that discovery was around 1810 or so. The discovery was documented in the London Museum, where it lay unnoticed for 60 years. Interest in the petroglyph, along with similar finds, picked up with the discovery of the Armana letters in 1887, these are in Egypt, which contain references to the Hittite Empire in numerous instances. A German professor by the name of Hugo Winkler was one of the people who grew to become obsessed with cracking the riddle of the unknown language. In Istanbul, in 1905, the professor was presented with a cuneiform tablet that had writing on it, which no one could recognize. Now, they took it to Winkler because he knew multiple ancient languages, including Babylonian, Assyrian, and Egyptian, but he didn't know what it was. He was told the tablet came from some ruins discovered in central Anatolia near a town called Bagaskoy. Winkler and the team headed off to Bagaskoy, driving deeper and deeper into remote regions that became remoter and remoter, until he happened to cross the massive ruins of the Hittite capital, Hattusa. Of course, Winkler, he didn't know this at the time, but he knew that whoever created these ruins, they must have possessed a civilization sophisticated enough to be a contender for the then mythical Fourth Empire. After weeks of searching, Winkler and his team kept finding more and more tablets written in the unknown language until finally his team discovered a tablet written in a known language, Babylonian, Akkadian, really. The tablet they found was none other than a document of the treaty between Ramses the Great and King Hattusili. What caught Winkler's eye was that the words seemed to be coming from Ramses, and he referred to Hattusili as a great king. And this is a title that is reserved only for the most important of kings, kings such as ruled great empires, not petty kingdoms. Winkler had found his fourth empire. Winkler, however, died before an even greater discovery, the discovery of a library that held over 30,000 Hittite tablets, had been made right there on the site of Hattusa. And while the discovery of the tablets was a major breakthrough, the language of the Hittites was still unknown. Now you eat bread and you drink water. In 1917, a Czech linguist named Bedřich Grosny finally cracked the Hittite code. And he did it with two key words, Nindaan, which was a word used by multiple languages to mean bread, and Wa'a'atr, an English word, one that you may know. water. What he had discovered was that Hittite, the language, was an Indo-European language. And this same sentence included the word Ezza, which was similar to an old High German word meaning to eat. The sentence, "Now you eat bread and you drink water," emerged, from which the work of deciphering the whole of the Hittite language rapidly unfolded. The work could now begin of translating the 30,000 tablets, from which I was able to relate to you so far, in small part, the story of the Hittites. But the 30,000 tablets were silent on exactly how the Hittites came to their sudden end. For that, many more decades would pass, all up until right around the turn of this century. A discovery of hieroglyphs would eventually lead to an unraveling of the mystery of the Hittites. Written in Hittite, but in a little-known hieroglyph form, researchers from around the world contributed to the deciphering of these enigmatic carvings. What the hieroglyphs revealed is that the Hittites had devolved into civil war as rival factions competed for the throne. The archaeological evidence showed extensive fire damage to key parts of the city. Now we get to the conclusion. In the 30,000 tablets, a story of the Hittites emerges that reveals, well, complex people, people capable of producing poetry, people capable of desiring justice, of demonstrating compassion for those with less power. But that was only part of the story. And even some of the documentaries that I watched, that was more the focus that they gave. I touched upon the nature of their religion, the nature of their laws, their literature. But what I have presented is but a small sliver of the complexity of all three aspects of their culture, their religion, their laws, their literature. What the 30,000 tablets showed was that the Hittites were a culture, and this is my supposition, they are a culture primarily based on fear and loyalty. They feared their enemies. For this reason, they strove to create an invincible stronghold in an impossible land. They strove to build a ruthless war machine that could vanquish their enemies before their enemies vanquished them. They feared their gods, and thus they created a complex law code filled with restrictions that touched almost every aspect of their lives, including sex, as I talked about, lest they offend their gods through bad behavior. They were, perhaps, the predecessors of rule of law in the West, but they were also a civilization that echoed what would come through the even more controlling, even more fear and loyalty-based city-state, the Spartans. And I should, a little side note here, that the founding fathers of America would often cite the Constitution of the Spartans as a direct influence on the formation of the American Constitution. I'll just let that sit there for you to digest as you will. Even today, these two characteristics, loyalty and fear, are still the favorite tools of empire builders, powerful people who need to control vast numbers of other people in order to extend their empires. They didn't emerge so much as they were engineered from the top down, for one purpose, to consolidate and extend power for the benefit of the ruling elite. They built a system reflected in their very city that placed them at the mercy of the lowest classes, and thus it required a near total control of every aspect of their lives. Now, on the flip side of that, it also required, to a certain degree, that the lower classes be given some mercy. Thank you for the mercy. We appreciate that. Without the appeal to fear, without the appeal to loyalty, what person would trade the life, even of a hunter-gatherer, for the life of a city dweller who daily toiled just to assure that the city set among mountains would have water delivered to it? Yeah, it was a Herculean effort just to assure that water was delivered to the city daily. Are the nation states of today, such as America, China, Russia, not also using their own appeals to fear and loyalty to control the ruled at the benefit of the ruling? I know in my social media feeds, what do I see? I see constant parades of the boogeymen of America, the Russians, ISIS, the Democrats, the Republicans, the SJWs, the alt-righters, the gun grabbers, Antifa. That's just some examples. I see constant parades on my social media of the calls to loyalty. You must respect the flag. You must respect our military and our police. You must respect the democracy. You must defend the little people. Feed the poor. Vanquish the enemy. What broke up the Hittites in the end was not a revolt from the ruled, but a struggle for power among those who would vie for the throne. And perhaps I support that those who escaped into the wilderness after the collapse may have been better off than living behind a life behind the walls, daily toiling for the rulers just to keep the fortress alive. Are we here in America to wait for the rulers to pick each other off, or are we set about weaning ourselves off of our dependence on this fortress built in an impossible place where its very existence necessitates the need to control the very people that keeps it alive? And there's another lesson that I believe that we learn from the Hittites, and this comes from the discovery. The very nature of the discovery of the Hittites, it serves as another lesson for us today. For 3,000 years, when people reflect on the past, a key part of that past was omitted. It wasn't omitted intentionally. It was omitted because the Hittites, as a final act, assured that their city would not give up its secrets, would not become the home to another people. So they set it on fire. Historians wrote about the emergence of civilization. Historians wrote about the foundations of Western civilization. And I know I've read some of those books that were written before the 20th century, such as Edward Gibbon's Fall and Decline of the Roman Empire. They wrote with much certainty about the reality of history, but all the while, unbeknownst to them, a key component of that history was left out, a component that led directly and indirectly to the foundation of the languages spoken in Europe, to the religions practiced by some of the key civilizations of Europe, and perhaps even to the so-called Western concept of rule of law, almost 1,000 years before Sparta wrote a constitution or the Romans formed their republic. They painted a complex portrait of the evolution of civilization in general, and Western civilization in particular. Yet, all the while, a key player in both those stories, the Hittites, was left undocumented until the 20th century, with the full story of the Hittites still being discovered even as you're listening to this. That 3,000-year absence of the Hittites serves as a reminder to us all that certainty may not be so certain after all. What we think we understand, what we think we know, could one day be challenged by even more discoveries that could yet lead us, once again, to rethink what we know about the emergence of civilizations or states. For those of us who reject the model of governance known as the state, or as I like to put it, coercive enterprise governance, understanding how humans stepped away from voluntary governance and embraced coercive enterprise governance is key to understanding how, perhaps, one day, humans can once again return back to the voluntary forms of governance that knit our communities together for most of our existence here on planet Earth. The Hittites show us that what we think we understand about the emergence of the state, coercive enterprise governance, may not reflect the actual truth of how that emergence occurred. And I'm betting that there are plenty of surprises ahead, surprises that could one day even surpassed the incredibly implausible surprise of discovering one of the most powerful empires of the Bronze Age, an empire that had lasting effects on the very civilization you now find yourself in a full 3,000 years after it disappeared. That civilization was the Hittites, or as they called themselves, the Nesili.